Welcome to the Solid Faith Podcast and YouTube channel. My guest today is Dr. Lydia McGrew. Dr. McGrew received her PhD in English from Vanderbilt University in 1995. She's been published extensively in philosophical journals such as Philosophical Studies, Acta Analytica, the Journal of Philosophical Research. She, alongside her husband, Timothy McGrew, co-wrote an article on the resurrection of Jesus, which is featured in the Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology. She wrote an article on historical inquiry for the Routledge Companion to Theism. She wrote a book in 2017 called Hidden in Plain View, Undesigned Coincidences in the Gospels and Acts. Last year, 2019, she released a book called The Mirror or the Mask, Liberating the Gospels from Literary Devices. She's currently writing a book on the Gospel of John, all of which we will discuss today. I want to welcome you to the Solid Faith Podcast, and thank you for joining us. So Lydia, thank you for joining the podcast today, coming on to speak with us. I really appreciate it.
It's great for you to have me, Clark. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll jump in. We're going to talk today about the Gospels, whether they are reliable, factual, eyewitness accounts. We're going to talk about reportage models and what that means in comparison to some of the other models that are out there. So I've seen you mention in various places that you endorse a reportage model of the Gospels. So what does that mean? What does it mean to say that the Gospels support a reportage model?
So just very briefly, what I mean by that is not anything very technical. I just mean that the authors were trying to give historical facts about the life and teachings of Jesus accurately in a literal way, and that they were highly successful in doing that. So it's just this kind of two-part thing that they were not trying to change anything. They were trying to get it right, and they did get it right.
Right. And I think most Christians assume that going into reading the Gospels. And I know there are a lot of Christians who hold to the view of inerrancy or biblical inerrancy. So would you conflate, or is this identical with the reportage model? Is it identical with biblical inerrancy?
That's an excellent question. I would say it is compatible with inerrancy. In fact, all traditional inerrantists would hold to a reportage model, but it doesn't necessarily entail it. So the reportage model would assert high literal factual reliability. It would be possible to hold to the reportage model while not being an inerrantist. You might think that there were a few good faith errors in the Gospels. But if you are a traditional inerrantist, you definitely should hold to a reportage model. So the implication goes the one way, but not the other. But the two are closely related.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk a lot about your newest book that was written in 2019, just a few months ago, actually. And it's called The Mirror or the Mask. And I think the title is interesting, Liberating the Gospels from Literary Devices. Also, the artwork on the front is interesting. I'll give you a little bit of time to kind of, show that to those who are watching on YouTube. We're going to talk about some of that artwork and what it might mean or what it might represent. So what does the phrase mirror or the mask mean? And what does it mean to say you want to liberate the Gospels from literary devices?
Well, I'm talking about two different ways of looking at the Gospels. You could look at them as a mirror of Jesus, where they're reflecting who Jesus was, what he said, what he did, and not only Jesus, but other people as well, John the Baptist, the disciples, and so forth. So they're accurate if they're a mirror, and they reflect by a natural process that the light rays, bounce off the mirror and so forth back into the eye. And the natural process in this case would be the natural process of witness testimony and of people telling what they know and giving that to other people. Or the mask, which would be something that would come between the viewer and the face of Jesus or the face of others. So as you can see in the artwork on the front, we've got the face of Jesus. That's a Rembrandt painting, which is fine. It's still very realistic. He used a Jewish young model as his model there. And that would be like the mirror. That's his face. Jesus looks rather unhappy in this picture, which is part of what I like about it. And then there's this mask, and you can view that as either coming down onto his face or coming off of his face. So if the gospel authors had an agenda, then in that agenda changed their factual reporting, then that would be a mask that would come between us and Jesus. And you can either think of that mask as something that the critics are trying to put on to Jesus, or a mask that I'm trying to take off. So when I talk about liberating the Gospels from literary devices, I'm specifically talking about the kind of devices that involve changing what happened in the facts. I'm not talking about just writing well or, you know, being a good author or something like that that doesn't involve factual change. But I'm talking about liberating the Gospels from that idea that the authors changed what happened.
Hmm. Yeah, so could you give us, or for those who are really new to this, some specific examples maybe of what you mean by literary devices that scholars are saying are present in the Gospels, but that you think are not really there?
Right. So these are sometimes called compositional devices, and they range from the small to the large. So there are things that might seem small until you start thinking about the fact that on these theories, those of someone like Dr. Michael Lacona or Dr. Craig Evans, these would be deliberate. These would be things that were being done deliberately. So if your friend deliberately told you that someone was present in a certain incident who he knew was not really present, even though that might not make a really big difference to the story, that would still make a pretty big difference to how much confidence you would have in your friend, because he deliberately added that person and told it realistically in such a way that it really looked like that person was present. So a supposedly minor example would be that Dr. Lacona says that Matthew deliberately made it appear that a centurion came personally to Jesus to talk to Jesus when Matthew knew that he really sent messengers and he wasn't there, and that he wrote his story. He makes him come. Not just that he wrote in a way that could be taken that way, but deliberately makes him come. Well, that would be kind of weird for somebody to deliberately give you the impression that somebody was there who really wasn't. That's not something that we would normally do in ordinary conversation. But there are also much bigger ones. So, for example, Dr. Craig Evans has said that many of the I am sayings in John, like I am the bread of life or I am the light of the world, were not recognizably uttered by Jesus at all, that they were the creative reflections of the Johannine community. Or Dr. Lacona thinks that Jesus did not really say, I thirst, or it is finished, on the cross. Those were John's reworkings of completely different sayings, like, my God, why have you forsaken me? Into your hands I commit my spirit. So that's a pretty big thing to make up these sayings. And he thinks that Luke moved the entire first appearance to the disciples after Jesus' resurrection, that it really occurred in Galilee, and Luke moved it to Jerusalem and made it happen in Jerusalem. Now, that's pretty big, because it's kind of going to make it very hard to fit in the Doubting Thomas episode. You know, John is very explicit that Jesus appeared to them first in Jerusalem, and Thomas wasn't with him, and he didn't believe them. And then a week later, still in Jerusalem, Jesus appears to them when Thomas happens to be there. I really don't think Thomas was going to walk all the way to Galilee to see Jesus when he didn't believe it. So this makes a difference. It makes a difference to apologetics. It makes a difference to a lot of things. Those are just a few examples. I give many, many more examples in the mirror or the mask. And I think a lot of people aren't aware of the nature of these devices, but that's what we're talking about, those kinds of factual changes.
Absolutely. You know, and I have a great deal of respect for Lacona and for Craig Evans and these scholars. And, you know, I think what may be something that scholars are trying to do is to find a way to rebut or to respond to the claims of skeptics who actually don't believe that these scriptures are inspired by God, or that don't believe that Jesus rose again. And so, you know, those skeptics, they claim that the Bible is just rife with contradictions. And I think Christians are trying to figure out how to respond to that. And so you have given a different approach, is to say, hey, maybe we don't need to give too much ground here. Maybe we can, you know, stand firm on certain things. But it's still a response to the skeptics who are claiming there are contradictions in the New Testament. And I know college students, for example, who are Christians, that they step foot on a college campus, this is one of the first things they'll hear in a
Sure.
class is, well, the Bible is just rife with contradictions. The New Testament is. So let's talk about that for just a moment. What are some of the alleged contradictions that skeptics bring up? How do you reconcile those as opposed to those who are trying to use literary devices to
Sure.
reconcile those contradictions?
Sure. And I agree. I think a lot of these alleged literary devices are response to alleged contradictions. I should admit, I have a section in The Mirror of the Mask called Utterly Unforced Errors. And that refers to places where these compositional devices are alleged, where there isn't an alleged contradiction. And so that does happen. And I think that arises from that view of the Gospels as being in a genre where they were, you know, allowed to make these changes. Then you're not necessarily going to wait for an apparent discrepancy, because there's no real reason to wait for an apparent discrepancy that could just pop up anywhere. So it may have been originally motivated that way, and that is still part of the motive. And I think it's part of the motive for people who accept those views, but it is not confined to that. But definitely skeptics like Bart Ehrman are pushing on these. So right now we're in the Easter season. So a good example there would be the alleged discrepancies in the Easter narratives. One pretty famous one there is that in Matthew 28, Mary Magdalene comes with the other Mary. And if you just read Matthew all by itself, you would get the impression that Mary never leaves, and that the women all see the angels, and then the angels say he is risen and go tell his disciples, and they run to see the disciples, and on their way, Jesus meets them. Now, Matthew names Mary Magdalene, and then he just says they, you know, they did this, they did that, they ran, etc., and saw Jesus. Certainly, a very natural reading there is that Mary Magdalene is there as well, but he doesn't actually say they, by which I mean, including Mary Magdalene, she never left. You know, he doesn't say that. When you go over and you read John, you see that she did leave the rest of the group of women. They came. They saw the stone rolled away. They thought that Jesus, someone had taken the body, that Jesus' body was gone. And so she just goes, she just runs and finds Peter and the beloved disciple. And I think that's a very simple harmonization. It's very natural when we have these two accounts that what Matthew is doing and Mark and Luke as well, is you can think of their camera, as it were, as following along with the experience of the other women. Okay, who go up to the tomb and they go in and they see the angel and so forth. And in Luke, it says that they went in. And then you can think of the camera in John as following Mary Magdalene. And she leaves and she goes back. And so we just apply the idea that these people are not all chained together at the wrist. You know, they're allowed to move around, you know. And that's actually a very reasonable thing to do. When we harmonize, we're just being responsible historically. We're not doing some desperate thing because we're theologically bound to. This is actually a very responsible historical method. We're trying to take all our data into account. So Lacanus says that either John or Matthew changed the story and relocated the appearance. Now, that would be pretty big change, actually, especially if John changed it. He would have to be making up the whole scene between Jesus and Mary Magdalene, because that scene assumes that she hasn't seen, you know, she hasn't talked to the angel. She doesn't know that Jesus is risen, and she doesn't see him when she's running away with joy to tell the disciples. She's still sad. She still thinks Jesus' body has been stolen. So relocated is kind of a small word for a big change there. Another type of alleged contradiction concerns the fact that there's a lot of unique material in John's gospel. Bart Ehrman, the skeptical scholar especially, will try to treat that as if it's a contradiction. So the argument from silence is Bart Ehrman's favorite argument. I mean, I would say it's one of his favorites. And so he'll say, surely, you know, surely if Jesus really had said Before Abraham was, I am. I am the father of one. The Matthew, Mark, and Luke would have reported it. So he'll use that to cast doubt on the account in John. Like, it can't be historical if it wasn't reported in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And in a 2012 debate, Dr. Craig Evans agreed with him. He agreed that those were not historically uttered in a recognizable fashion by Jesus. But the argument from silence is very poor there. This is something my husband has done. Tim McGrew has done a great article on, professional article on the argument from silence. You'd be amazed in history at the things that we think people would say that they don't say. So one of the best of these is Ulysses Grant has memoirs that cover the Civil War that never mentioned the Emancipation Proclamation. Mm. And, you know, you would definitely expect that he would. So our own ideas of what we would expect people to mention need to be recalibrated. We need to realize that we often just don't even know why people don't mention certain things. And to use that argument from silence against testimony, I mean, it's fine, you know, for me to argue from the fact that I do not see a grizzly bear here in this room, that there is not a grizzly bear in this room. You could call that an argument from silence. But it's quite a different matter for someone to come and tell me that there was a car accident and me to say, well, I didn't hear anything about a car accident. And, you know, this is like my friend who says, I saw a car accident on this corner. And for me to say, well, I didn't hear that from anyone else, so I'm not going to believe you. Like, everything has to be said twice.
Right.
Everything doesn't have to be said twice. And similarly, we don't have to have two records that Jesus said before Abraham was I am. We only need one credible record that Jesus said before Abraham was I am. So that would be another alleged contradiction. And just a third one would be the temple cleansing. So you'll have the argument that John tells of the temple cleansing early in Jesus' ministry, and the synoptics tell of him cleansing the temple later in his ministry. Some people see this as a contradiction. You know, interestingly, there isn't really a contradiction there when you think about it between his cleansing the temple early and his cleansing the temple late. You know, unless we assume that he only did it once. And that's not really an assumption we should make. Something that I often point out is that, you know, protesters will often protest the same thing twice, whether they're nuclear protesters or anti-abortion protesters or whatever. They'll go to the same place, you know, and they'll make the same symbolic protest on more than one occasion. And it's 3.5 years apart. There's no reason not to think that Jesus would have gone back and done this again. And the accounts are not uncannily similar either. There are variations in the accounts. If we knew they were the same event, we could harmonize those variations. But there's no need to think they're the same event. So, for example, I believe oxen are mentioned in John, but not the synoptics. And I believe the whip is mentioned in one, but not in the other. It could be the same account. But why think that when the two place them so clearly in different locations? So I definitely think the vast majority of these alleged contradictions can be harmonized in very straightforward, very responsible, very reasonable traditional fashion.
Would it be fair to say, Lydia, that your book is sort of, in a nutshell, you're trying to find, not trying to find, but you're just arguing for the simplistic answer versus something that violates Occam's razor, for example, that would just be unnecessary to add to these accounts. It seems to me like that's what I gather from you, is that you're just saying that we don't have to go as far as X. We can stop here.
Right. I think a lot of times there's a failure to recognize the burden and the complexity that is being taken on. So, for example, take the theory that John moved the temple cleansing. So what we have to have is John intending to move it, saying, I know it happened at the end, but I'm going to move it to the beginning. Then we have to also add some kind of motive for that. Like, he wanted to symbolize that Jesus' entire life was Passion Week or something. That's a motive you'll hear. It's very this secret motive. It's like a secret symbolic theological motive. Well, man, that's violating. I think that's very much violating Occam's razor. We're making up this motive that you can't even see. Then we're going to add that his readers wouldn't have minded that his readers would not have been confused. Well, I think they would have been confused. I don't think we have any reason to think they would not have been confused. St. Augustine, who was much closer to that time period than we are, said it was evident that Jesus cleansed the temple twice. And Augustine was trained in rhetoric, and he doesn't think there's some sort of literary device there. So you've got to add that. And, you know, are the readers supposed to be reading John's mind to figure out that he had this theological motive? Oh, wow, this is so profound. Jesus' whole life is within, it's like a one long passion week. Why should we think they read John's mind, you know, to think that? So I do think there's a tremendous violation of Occam's razor that's going on with these extra literary or theological theories that are being added. In the mirror, the mask, I use a flow chart to illustrate that burden of proof. So, like, first of all, is there even a discrepancy at all? Sometimes there isn't. Second of all, can we do some kind of a very reasonable harmonization? You know, third of all, would the author have known? Would he have been doing it deliberately? Because that's a separate issue, especially in secular writings where inerrancy doesn't even come into play. An author could have just made an honest mistake. He wouldn't necessarily have been doing it deliberately. You know, so we've got to go through all of these. And then, if he did it deliberately, again, especially let's consider secular writings, maybe he was just lying. You know, why should we assume that it was a literary device rather than propaganda? Propaganda isn't a literary device. Mm. You know, if we find some politician, he's making something up, it's not a literary device. He's just a propagandist, you know? So you have to jump through all these hoops in order to even conclude that there is a literary device there. And I think it is important to remember that there's a pretty big burden of proof.
Yeah, just to add on to this question about alleged contradictions, and this wasn't in my notes, but are there any contradictions that you feel like are pretty solid that you haven't been able to, or is there anything that stands out that you haven't been able to find out how to harmonize that or to make sense of that? Is there any particular contradiction?
Yeah, there are a few that I have not found harmonizations in the Gospels in particular, which is what I've studied more than the Old Testament, where I haven't found harmonizations I'm satisfied with, is the way I would put that. Now, I want to distinguish two different approaches here. A traditional inerrantist, when that happens, will say, I don't know. And I think that's a very legitimate thing to do. If someone is a traditional inerrantist, it's much better to say, I don't know, than to say, well, the author changed it on purpose. Okay, that's so, you don't have to go there. You don't always have to have something to say. You can just say, I don't have something to say, or I don't have a theory to sell you, you know? So an example there of one that I don't have a satisfactory harmonization for would be the centurion example that I mentioned before, where it really does seem like Matthew is indicating that the centurion came in person, and Luke is very explicit that he sent messengers. You can do a traditional harmonization there by saying at first he sent messengers and then he came. And then later Jesus looked and saw him in the crowd and said, because the verb there is plural, you know, go in peace. Excuse me, I misspoke. It's singular. Go in peace. Sorry. So he's not speaking to the messengers. He seems to, in Matthew, to be speaking, you know, directly to the centurion. You can do that. That seems to me a little over complex, actually, as a harmonization. Luke had not been called by Jesus, apparently, yet at that time. Boy, I seem to be misspeaking a lot. Edit that out. Excuse me. Matthew had not been called, apparently, at that time yet, in Jesus' ministry as a disciple, to be one of the 12. So Matthew probably got that story from someone else. So perhaps that some accidental confusion took place in the relaying of that story. But notice that there's a big difference between saying that Matthew made the centurion be there when he knew he wasn't, and saying that Matthew just got confused and thought he was there and wrote it that way because he was legitimately confused. That's not the way we talk in ordinary conversation. You know, you'll hear this phrase, the guy version. So I give this example. I was at the Defend conference in New Orleans in January. Suppose that a guy went to the Defend conference and Dr. William Lane Craig was not there. And he went home and he told his friend, I had a great conversation with William Lane Craig at Defend. And then his friend found out that William Lane Craig was not there and said, you know, did you just get confused? Were you thinking of the ETS back in November? Because Dr. Craig was there. Oh, no, it was a literary device. I spoke with one of Dr. Craig's students, and he brought me messages from Dr. Craig. So I made a story of it where I told you that I spoke directly to Dr. Craig. That's just the guy version. I mean, it's not. It's not how we do things normally. And so I think people do get confused about that, about what's actually being said. So that would be one that I have not found a satisfactory harmonization for myself too. And I think if you're a traditional inerrantist, you should probably just say there's just something we don't know.
Right. You know, there's nothing, as you point out, there's nothing wrong with saying, I don't know the answer to a specific thing. You know, it doesn't mean that it won't come to light as we continue studying, but it does mean that, you know, you're being honest intellectually and saying, I don't understand this particular thing. You mentioned inerrancy, and you mentioned earlier that the reporter's model is compatible with inerrancy, but it doesn't require inerrancy. So in your view, what is biblical inerrancy, and where do you stand on that?
So I do not call myself an inerrantist. I would take biblical inerrancy to have to do with there not being any factual historical errors. I mean, it means a lot of things, includes a lot of things. But in this context, there would not be historical errors in books that definitely present themselves as historical. And subsequent to the Chicago Statement on Biblical Inerrancy, there was one called the Chicago Statement on Biblical Hermeneutics that made that even more explicit, that you can't just take the word genre and kind of slap it down on some subsection of a book that sure looks completely historical and say, but this section is a different genre, or something like that, where you're dehistoricizing a book that for all appearances looks historical. And frankly, if the Gospels and Acts, to name certain groups in the Bible, are not historical, then nothing is. I mean, if they're not historical in genre, I don't know what is, because they really are sort of paradigmatically. So it's been interesting to see how old style inerrantists, I would call them, have responded to my work. I've tried to be very upfront that I'm not an inerrantist because of examples like the one I gave a moment ago, where I would say, well, maybe there is just an error there, a good faith error. They have appreciated that. So people like John Warwick Montgomery, the late Norm Geisler, whom I never met, but who was having my book, parts of my book read to him before he passed away last summer, Phil Fernandez of the International Society of Christian Apologetics. I did a big interview, two-part interview with Phil Fernandez on inerrancy and biblical inerrancy that's out there online. And they've just appreciated that because they would prefer that I would say I'm not an inerrantist rather than to redefine inerrancy and say, well, I'm an inerrantist because inerrancy means that, you know, they don't change anything important or something. Well, that's not all that inerrancy, you know, is supposed to mean. It's supposed to mean they didn't change the details either. So I would consider my own position to be far more akin to that of the traditional inerrantists, ironically, than the position of a compositional device theorist, even if that person calls himself an inerrantist and I don't. So it's this kind of strange irony that's going on.
Yeah. You know, in your book, you definitely have critical things to say about the ideas of literary device theorists. And of course, you know, that's going to take up some of a large part of your book is addressing those claims or, you know, responding to them. But is there sort of a positive side to Mirror in the Mask, a more positive side than just the critical side of things you're doing?
Yeah, and that's really important to me because I do not want people to think that the case for the reportage model consists entirely of saying that the literary device model is wrong. There's also a positive case to be made for it. And that's one reason why I want to emphasize that readers do not have to read every chapter. I provide chapter summaries, so you can look at the chapter summaries and then read certain chapters in more detail. So I provide a lot of positive evidence that the Gospels are true reportage. For example, details that are confirmed from extra biblical sources. And these are sometimes very subtle details, and that's what's cool too. It's not just, okay, the Gospels mention Herod or something. That's fine too. But sometimes those subtle things are even better. Internal indications of realism in the documents. It's very important to remember here, hyper-realistic fiction, such as we now have, was unknown at that time, and it was unknown for many centuries thereafter. They did not have authors writing this stuff that, my goodness, you know, it just really, really looks like it's true and realistic, but it isn't. They didn't have that. So it's very anachronistic to suggest that the authors were adding these realistic details just to make the story appear to believable. Casualness is a very important thing here. The authors don't look like rhetoricians, high-flown, you know, trying to wring your emotions, trying to paint an elaborate picture. What they look like are witnesses giving what we could call oral history, where they're just saying what they remember. They're mentioning things in a kind of a haphazard way as they come up. And I also talk about the unity of the personalities in the Gospels. I also talk about things that would make for poor fiction, but make for good oral history. So some of these I call unexplained allusions. When an author will just mention something and he just kind of leaves it hanging there, it's not a foreshadowing of anything else. It doesn't have any deep meaning, and it just kind of moves on. If you get someone to talk to you about maybe an event that happened many years ago, he'll do that, you know? Yeah, I remember that was the day my cat got sick. You know, and then he'll just move on, you know, nothing more about the cat, right? But that's how it's stuck in his mind, okay? That's not good fiction, not even good modern fiction, but it's good oral history. So, for example, we find John saying they went down from Cana to Capernaum and they stayed there for a few days. That's John 2:12, Jesus and his disciples and his mother and brothers. And he just stops. And then he says, the feast of the Passover was near, and Jesus went to Jerusalem, and he goes on to narrate the temple cleansing. And that trip to Capernaum, it just gets dropped, you know. Plus, going down from Cana to Capernaum is one of those little casual indications, because Cana's in the hills, and Capernaum is at sea level, so you do go down. And that's how we talk about things. I went down here, I went down there, when it really is down, because we really know the topography. The Gospel of John is probably being released in Asia Minor, pretty far from Cana. So it's not like John's original audience is going to say, ooh, cool, he put in that bit about going down from Cana to Capernaum. They're probably not even going to notice. But it's a casual indication of accuracy and truthfulness. So I've got a lot of this really wonderful evidence, positive evidence for reportage. And I just want to throw in here, we should not make the gospel author schizophrenic. If we have evidence that they are just truthful reporters or just telling it at like it is, as it comes to their minds, it is, again, a violation of Occam's razor to say, well, they do that most of the time. But every once in a while, they put on their literary hat. And then when they put on their literary hat, then they do this subtle factual change. And then they take their literary hat back off, and then they go back to just reporting. It makes more sense to have a unified personality to the author that he, you know, if we're finding all this evidence that he's truthful in this just ordinary sort of way, then it makes more sense that that's just what he is like all the time.
Mm. Yeah, you know, we had the famous apologist, cold case homicide detective, J. Warner Wallace on. And yes. One of the things that he talks about is, as a cold case detective, when you get witnesses together and you interview them one at a time, you might get what's called undesigned coincidences. You mentioned this often as well, where they're telling the same story. Maybe they witnessed a car crash, or maybe they witnessed a murder, or whatever the case may be, but they saw it from different angles. And so they're just telling their story, and there seems to be things that at first glance may not seem to, like, you know, coalesce. But then, as you put the whole picture together, you see that there's these coincidences from each person's story that paint the truth. I mean, you're getting different angles of the truth, but you're getting the truth. And so I wonder if you could elaborate on an undesigned coincidence. What is that? And maybe give us an example of that.
Yeah, and I have more of these in The Mirror or The Mask. I had a whole book on them earlier, which is called Hidden in Plain View, Undesigned Coincidences in the Gospels and Acts. I have an Acts section in that too. And Dr. Craig Keener wrote a foreword to that, but J. Warner Wallace wrote an afterword to Hidden in Plain View. So that was very cool. I wanted to have Wallace there. Wallace is one of the only people other than my husband, Tim, and me, and also Peter Williams, who is a very eminent British New Testament scholar, who have revived the argument from undesigned coincidences. And then I have additional ones in The Mirror or The Mask. I call an undesigned coincidence an incidental interlocking that points to truth. So a contemporary example would be if you have a robbery, we'll use a crime example since we've been talking about J. Warner Wallace. So one witness says he tripped on his way out of the bank. The culprit tripped on his way out of the bank. And then another witness, without mentioning tripping, says, I noticed that his shoelace was untied. So that's an undesigned coincidence. Neither witness appears to be trying to allude to the other one. Neither one says, oh yeah, that's right, he tripped, and I bet I know why that would, that wouldn't look, they might still be telling the truth, but that wouldn't look so casual. Casualness is very important here. It's that they're each just telling these different things, and those things fit together, that he tripped because he had an untied shoelace, so we surmise. So similarly, when Jesus is speaking to the disciples on the night in which he was betrayed, he says they're having a fight about who's the greatest in the kingdom. And Luke reports this. And Jesus says that the one who is the least among you should be the greatest, will be the greatest. Okay. And the leader should be the servant of all. And he says, who is greater? The one who reclines at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at the table? But I am among you as the one who served. They reclined at the tables back then. Now, in Luke, this is unexplained because it appears that Jesus is reclining at the table. So we would say, what does he mean? I am among you as the one who serves. He's reclining at the table with them. It says that. Why is he saying this? But when we go over to John, we find that he washed their feet. So when he says, is it not the one who reclines at the table, but I am the one who is among you as the one who serves. John says he rose from supper and girded himself with a towel and washed their feet. So he wasn't just reclining at the table anymore. He took upon him the job of a servant and washed their feet. And I think that is what he is alluding to, what Jesus is alluding to in the Gospel of Luke. So they fit together as a question and an answer. Similarly, here's an example related to the temple cleansing. I was talking about the temple cleansing earlier. We find in the synoptic gospels, which are Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that there is a good deal of early opposition to Jesus. In Luke, it mentions that up in Galilee, which is a good 70 miles north of Jerusalem, there were these scribes that had been sent from Judea to hear Jesus. And they're there when he says to the man, your sins are forgiven you. And they say, this is blasphemy. No one can forgive sins. Well, what are they doing there? You know, I mean, that's kind of a long trip. Did they just go to investigate, you know, everybody? Similarly, in Mark, we find that they're there. And it specifically says that they had been sent from the leaders in Jerusalem. And when Jesus casts out demons, they're like very hostile. They say he casts out demons by Beelzebub, the prince of demons. So they already are hostile to him. It's really odd, this early opposition to Jesus by people who have been sent all the way from Jerusalem up to Galilee, because there's not been any clash between Jesus and the religious leaders in Jerusalem reported in Mark or in Luke yet up to that point. So if you think of the temple cleansing early, which is reported in John, this could definitely provide a motive because they even challenge him in John. They say, what sign do you give of your authority to do this? And he kind of smarts off to them. He says, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up, which isn't exactly what they were looking for. So there's already been tension. And this could explain why they sent scribes to Galilee. Go find out what's up with this guy, you know, and he's a troublemaker. Go see if you can find anything against him. And that early hostility in the synoptics, I think, is well explained by the temple cleansing. So that, again, is an undesigned coincidence.
Right, yeah. And I would encourage readers to, or listeners, to go and read Hidden in Plain View, because it's full of those undesigned coincidences, which I think are really, really neat. It's almost like putting together a big puzzle, and you just start to see the pieces falling in place. And it just makes things, again, kind of harmonizes these accounts and helps you to understand them or rationalize the gospel accounts. But speaking of the gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John sort of always get categorized in the same group, get categorized in the same group, while John is sometimes like the oddball gospel. It's the one that stands out, right? So you are actually writing a book currently on the Gospel of John. So I wonder if you could tell listeners that may be interested in your work, kind of a brief synopsis of the book, and what would motivate you to write the book on the Gospel of John, sort of give us a big picture of what that book will look like.
Right. Now, there is John material in The Mirror or The Mask, but I considered that it was necessary to write a whole book just on John as well. That book is going to be called The Eye of the Beholder, and I have already commissioned the cover art for that. That has already been painted, and I won't give that away, but it's going to be pretty cool. So I've called that The Eye of the Beholder because I believe John was a beholder of Jesus' ministry, and then that he tells it in this realistic way as that beholder who really is reflecting this. And it's just like you said, I called John the redheaded stepchild of gospel scholarship. He looks different, right? And so that he's looked down upon as being different. And this means that it's important to defend John in a special way, that you can't just, you can do some work. The work that I do in The Mirror or The Mask on genre is very applicable to John, and it kind of clears the ground. So people can't just come along and say, well, we all already know that the gospel authors change things, so maybe just John just does it more. Okay, you know, then I'm questioning that we don't all already know that the gospel authors change things. So now let's look at John with fresh eyes, that maybe he doesn't do it either. And it'll have, once again, both a rebuttal or negative aspect and a positive aspect. I'll be providing all kinds of positive evidence that John is providing historical reportage. In fact, that undesigned coincidence I just gave concerning the hostility to Jesus, I got that from a paper by an Australian scholar named Alan Chappell. That's going to be in The Eye of the Beholder. And a lot of other evidence from the personality of Jesus. A lot of times we see it said that Jesus in John is very different from Jesus in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And I will be showing that that's not true, showing positively that Jesus is unified. And then I will also be responding to specific allegations or challenges that John, say, moved the day of the crucifixion or moved the temple cleansing, or that the discourses in John are different from the discourses in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and that kind of thing. So it's going to have, again, that kind of dual aspect. And I do this in a bit in The Mirror of the Mask, but even more in John. It's kind of a sandwich structure, a chiastic structure. So I start out with the positive evidence, then I go and I answer the objections, and then I go back and I give a lot more positive evidence. So I sort of start positive and I end positive in a sense. Then I have an appendix on authorship as well, because we do have to deal with authorship, but I didn't want authorship to just take over the whole book. So I do have a chapter on authorship and an appendix on authorship. So that's a synopsis of that book. And I'm giving people little, I would say little foretastes of it who follow my work, but there's going to be a lot more in there as well. So it's going to be exciting. My publisher also said that it would be fine for me to duplicate some material from The Mirror or The Mask, but I'm trying not to do too much of that. I'm just duplicating some of that material.
I look forward to it. Lydia, this has been an informative conversation. And I'm sure there are listeners who may want to learn more. So where could they find you? Where can they get your books? How could they find those books?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now, both Hidden in Plain View and The Mirror of the Mask are available on Amazon. They're also available on Barnes and Noble. So if we get a sudden rush of people buying them on Amazon, Amazon sometimes goes out of stock for a little while, then you can always go over and order it on Barnes and Noble. Hidden in Plain View is in Kindle as well. So if you just want to, not order a package right now because shipping's a little slower these days, you can get that one on Kindle. The Mirror of the Mask is only available in physical form right now. My author website is lydiamcgrew.com. That contains links to various scholarly blog posts and so forth that I've done on New Testament and other work. You can also follow me on Facebook, and you do not have to be my Facebook friend to follow me. You can go and find me. I have a red dress on. Just look up Lydia McGrew on Facebook and click follow, and you'll see all my public content. You won't see what I ate for supper, but you'll see stuff about gospel scholarship, sometimes things about social issues such as abortion or that kind of thing, but nowadays mostly gospel scholarship. You can also email me, lydiamcgrew@gmail.com, with questions. If you do email me, please give a little introduction of yourself. I like to know a little bit about you. Are you a Christian? Are you a seeker, et cetera? That's not to say I'm not going to talk to you if you're not a Christian, not at all. But I just like to kind of know my audience when I'm doing email, not to just get a sort of an anonymous email. But that would be great. You can contact me that way as well. So please do that, and please do follow me on Facebook, and you'll get updates, as the book comes out, because right now I am working hard on drafting the Eye of the Beholder. I'm polishing it. I'm writing those chapter summaries that I do think people find useful. I really think people like having those chapter summaries. So I'm writing those right now, and then I'll be seeking endorsements and so forth for that book as well, from other scholars. So I'm excited about it, and I hope it'll be out in 2021.
Yeah, for those listeners who are watching on YouTube, I'll be sure to link up your website and also the books Hidden in Plain View, Mirror of the Mask. That way, if they're interested, they can find it pretty easily by just looking at the links at the bottom of the
Thanks.
video. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Cool. This has been fun. Thank you so much for having me, Clark. And I hope that your readers will follow my work and will find it useful, whether they are unbelievers or believers in Christianity.
I appreciate you coming on, Lydia. It's been wonderful.
Thanks.
I pop a willy and move. I pop a willy and move. I pop a willy and move it. Continuous will of my music. Gassed up, you get passed up if you talk down. You get strapped up, got a sheet mask. I just